VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Tony Cascarino, Oliver Kay, and another debutant. Yes, we're pushing the boat out here. It's Mr. Tom Dart. We'll be discussing all the biggest action from the weekend, including Fulham against Manchester United and Stoke against Tottenham Hotspur. Also, the plight of lower league managers. Why do they never get a look in the top flight? And there may well be the odd reference to one of the weekend's goal feasts as well. All right, let's kick it off at the Cottage, Fulham and Manchester United. And I got to start with something. The game finished 2-2, but should we have, and I've been criticized because I'm not necessarily his biggest fan, a bit of an appreciation of Paul Scholes for the technique in taking that goal. Admittedly, it wasn't pretty good defending, but it was about as clean as you can strike it, right, Ollie?
It was a perfect strike. It was, I mean, if there's one person in, certainly in English football, that you would want running onto a ball like that 25 yards from goal, it would be Scholes. He's got the technique to keep the ball down in those situations. He's done it so many times down the years. And I think there's a bit of a Paul Scholes love in it at the moment, which is probably a sort of belated sort of recognition of what a great player he is. I don't think he's been doing anything particularly that he hasn't been doing for years, but I suppose this being Scholes, I think he'll probably be thoroughly sick of it and might be relieved that his wasn't the winning goal in some way.
Cass, can you just walk us through it, just from a technical aspect, what he actually did, what you need to do to strike the ball that cleanly? And don't tell me you didn't score many goals like that, because I still know your technique is probably better than the rest of us.
Well, first, it's a very similar to a golfing action where you're getting yourself in position as it falls to Scholes. He's totally fixed on his eye line, he's level, he keeps his body shape low, which keeps the ball down. He doesn't fall back at any time. I mean, he struck it knowing that he had to get over the top of the ball, meaning to keep the ball down and keep it low. Paul Scholes is probably, apart from Dennis Irwin, probably the cleanest striker of a football I've ever seen. He's done it a numerous time. I remember a goal at Villa Park, similar. Just falls to him. He manages to get into perfect position in his, you know, the way he's going to attempt to try and strike it so cleanly. He does it brilliantly. Keeping it down is the hardest thing as the ball's coming at you, because it comes at him at pace, doesn't it? When it gets played back, it comes at him at pace and comes firmly onto it. Everything's over the top of the ball, keeping it low.
Tom, United, I thought, dominated the game early on, and you know, and then there was the incident with the missed penalty. Was that sort of the turning point for you?
Yeah, just for sure. If they score that penalty, they go on and win comfortably. Instead, they let Fulham back in the game, and of course, when you miss a penalty, you give encouragement and a surge of adrenaline and belief to the other side, while you yourself are on a bit of a downer. So definitely.
Now, Wayne Rooney missed out, obviously. He had a stomach bug. I was just kind of thinking about this, because United don't have a game in midweek. And I'm assuming that, you know, he was, without getting too gross, he was probably on the bathroom, because that's normally a byword for what he had. Was he really in no condition to play? Any suggestion there might have been something else going on, Ollie?
I think you get lots of conspiratorial whispers in those kind of situations, but no, apparently he was ruled out on Saturday morning with the problem, and I see what you're getting at in saying, you know, that was almost 36 hours ahead of the game, and is it really necessary to rule him out? I haven't heard of anything to make me disbelieve Ferguson on that, apart from the fact that Ferguson has a sort of track record of being rather selective with the troops, but I don't think he's been bombed from a squad or anything like that.
Lots of players, Ollie, do, you know, play with tummy upsets, a bug of some sort. Normally, with the way that medicine's gone on, you can quickly eradicate any type of problem. I just think that maybe if it was that close, and because it was the morning of the game, maybe Fergie thought
it was the morning before the game.
Morning before? Well, that is,
that's what Ollie said Saturday morning.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's really strange, because 24 hours for a bug and a tummy upset is ample enough time to get ready for a game.
Sorry, Ollie.
I was just going to say that there was a rumour going around on Saturday night that there may be a hamstring problem. I haven't had that sort of corroborated by anybody, but I mean, that's maybe just an alternative theory. But of course, how can we doubt the word of Sir Alex?
Well, what the thing is that Wayne has been totally out of sorts, hasn't he, for a long time, even the end of last season. Maybe Fergie just maybe thought, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll have a look at Hernandez in this particular game, might take Wayne out the firing line, just to not give him a kick up the backside, but he's certainly, for I'd say probably 10 games, has been very, very indifferent for Man United and country.
I think statistically, I don't think he's scored, I think, since March at this stage. Although, to be fair, of course, there was the World Cup in the summer in between. But these are obviously 2 points drop for United. Chelsea are rolling on. And what struck me was, you know, we always throw out this cliche about big clubs knowing how to close out games and so on. You give up that last, you know, virtually last minute goal to Brede Hangeland. Tom, what's your take? Do we blame the defenders? Is it a collective letdown? Is that, you know, had the momentum shifted by that point?
I think United's defence is a concern without Rio Ferdinand for another couple of weeks. I think they're going to continue to look shaky. I think you can say it's only the second game of the season. Craven Cottage, despite being very small, is a surprisingly difficult place to go to, where when the Fulham fans get behind their team, it can be surprisingly intimidating and lively, so it's not always easy. United struggled there in the past couple of seasons, so I think there are maybe some mitigating circumstances, and as I said, the missed penalty was crucial, but United don't look completely solid, and if they're not going to score two or three every game, I think they could well have this scenario again where they drop a few more points on the road.
Well, what concerns me, Tom, is Vidic is not the player he was 2 years ago. If you look at him, he's continually trying to foul, he's trying to grab people's shirts, and he's trying to get close to them. For the goal, Hangeland, he's the one. I know he gets in front of Berbatov in the end, but that was his player. Hangeland was his player. And he's been out-jumped quite a few times.
Is that what happens when you sign a fat new contract, Cass?
Can, especially young lads, if they sign big deals, you're guaranteed the new car comes in the car park, and their performances will go to, you know, a lesser level. But I would certainly be concerned. Vidic is not the dominating figure he was probably 18 months, 2 years ago for me.
Ollie, is Johnny Evans going to kick on as well?
Yeah,
fair point. Is he really going to be the player we thought he was going to be 3 or 4 years ago?
Let's talk about Fulham now. The new Fulham to me looks a lot like the old Fulham, maybe because it's all the same players until Dembélé gets, who I actually really like as a signing, and I think is exactly what the doctor ordered, until he gets into the team. It seems to be Mark Hughes has been there all summer, but he hasn't really had a chance to go and do much wheeling and dealing, has he? Is Sparky a little bit annoyed, Cass?
No, I think he's come and done the right thing in the football club. He hasn't tried to do too much of a dramatic change. I think he will try and do something before the window closes. I think he also acknowledged that the group overachieved to some level last year. And
finishing 13th in the league.
I'm talking over the course of the season. Roy Hodgson done a hell of a job. They were great at Craven Cottage, as we all know. On the road, that's a different question. But what I think he's looked at is, I tell you what, I'll give everyone the same opportunity, keep this group together, and I'll add one or two to it. And I think it needs a bit of work, which it will do, like all clubs. He will add additions to the club, but I think he's done a really clever thing in just coming in and not making the old usual, they're not fit enough, or I need to do this, I need to go and buy him. I think he's just assessing everything at the football club.
Tom, we got to give a shout out to Stockdale, who of course saved that penalty. Are you buying Cass's line here about Fulham? Is there any you know, is Mark Hughes where he wants to be?
Well, I think he may have recognised that the key to Fulham's success last year in getting to the Europa League final and while staying in mid-table was that collective spirit and also picking the same team more or less every week. The familiarity of that was a key element to the success. If Hughes were to start chopping and changing, radically tinkering with the tactics and bringing a lot of new players and really having a lot of changes, I think that would actually damage Fulham, and especially with limited transfer funds available. I think he's doing the right thing by adding piecemeal here and there, trying to strengthen rather than trying to radically transform a team that is still very solid and should be very solid this season as well.
Moving on to, because we wouldn't be the game podcast without us talking about referees, would it now, and refereeing controversy. And Stoke and Tottenham, let's just get this out of the way. John Walters, late in the game, he could score the equalizer. His finish is blocked by Peter Crouch on the line. There may have been a foul before on Gomez, but the point being that Crouch saves it. And there's a whole debate about whether the ball actually crossed the line. Chris Foy is very well placed to judge it, and he reckons the ball didn't go through. Now, it was interesting, I was watching Match of the Day, and they made it seem as if it was like Frank Lampard's goal, and It was obvious that it crossed the line. Sure as hell didn't seem obvious to me, Tony.
Yeah, I'll tell you what really peed me off over the weekend was I was listening to a number of pundits, commentators, assessing that this is a goal, and I had the word maybe after watching the replay, maybe it's over the line. And then people saying, yes, I think it's over the line. Well, a referee has got to make a decision. If that whole ball is not over the line, he's not convinced. If he has any negative thought that it did not fully cross the line, he cannot give a goal. And yet we was listening to everybody. I was watching the goals on Sunday, and they're at the line. Chris Kamara's, you know, showing body positions and how it must have crossed the line. I'm thinking, hold it, a referee's got a split second to make a judgment of whether this was over the line. He has to be convinced, and like you just, I'm glad you just mentioned that, this is nowhere near a Frankie Lampard ball over the line. This was such a touch decision. I didn't know. I watched it on replays and I still don't know. That means it's not a goal.
Ollie, are Cass and I a bit slow that we can't see that the ball crossed the line, or are you with us?
No, I'm with you. And again, I was expecting it from what I heard on the radio. I was expecting it to be Pedro Mendes at Old Trafford, Frank Lampard type thing, and it wasn't of that type. I mean, it may well have gone over the line, but I couldn't see it from the position the TV cameras gave us. The referee couldn't see it from the position he was in, and I can understand why it wasn't given as a goal. And I guess that will get people saying, well, that proves that there should be goal line technology or whatever. And I say that certainly an extra pair of eyes, the old Michel Platini idea would be... you know, I think that would have resolved it, would it not?
Tom, any dissent from you?
Well, I'm not sure that having an extra assistant referee behind the goal line would have made any difference to this. The bodies in the way would have perhaps prevented him from seeing it. And if Chris Foy can't see it from where he's clearly or with certainty from where he's standing, then no one can, because Foy's position was completely perfect. So it just illustrates the difficulty. If you have the referee in a great position 5 yards away, you can't tell, and then we look at it on the replays, you know, several different angles, look at it again and again, and we still can't tell. Shows this is even maybe replays won't be able to solve the problem, unless perhaps there was a camera looking straight down on the goal line from, you know, the top of the crossbar.
Ollie, until a year ago, Gareth Bale was some kind of laughing stock. We had that funny statistic that, like, you know, they played 21 games or whatever it was for Spurs and they'd never won when he was in the starting lineup and so on. I know he's had injuries, but we can't really have it both ways here. He's either not that good, or we and the Tottenham coaching staff are kind of stupid in not realizing how good he was, right?
Well, I think players just, you know, players develop confidence. Players develop at different paces, and sometimes a penny can just drop, and a player just goes on an incredible roll, and they go from potentially a good player into an extremely good player almost overnight. And I think that, I mean, that almost is what happened with Cristiano Ronaldo to some extent at Manchester United. I'm not really comparing Bale with Ronaldo at this point, but the transformation has been sort of similar to the Ronaldo transformation of 3-4 years ago.
But Ronaldo was never a laughingstock, though.
Well, he was in a different way, because everyone, we used to go on about him being a crybaby and a diver and the ludicrous stepovers and so on. And I just mentioned Ronaldo because we're just talking about young players, the penny dropping, them suddenly looking like fulfilling their potential. And Bale just seems to have got his head right. He seems to have bulked up. He seems to have been encouraged and indulged by Harry Redknapp. But just looking at Harry Redknapp's quotes in the paper this morning, Harry Redknapp says that his sort of man management extended to just telling him, stop effing about with your barnet, which just goes to show. maybe it's sort of inverse Samson effect.
Tom, is this should we be giving credit to Harry Redknapp for taking Gareth Bale to this level, or should we be questioning why it took so long? Because, Spurs did, Redknapp didn't buy him, but Spurs did spend a lot of money on this kid when he was very young, and it was obvious that he had the skill set.
I think we have to give credit to Harry Redknapp for bringing him on, for playing him regularly, and for helping him develop. As Ollie said, it's perhaps open for debate just how much tactical genius Redknapp has helped along Bale with, but I suppose a lot of it, as Bale has matured and got older, naturally he's got better. He's had injury problems as well, which seem over now. So I imagine it's a combination of good management and coaching, and from Harry Redknapp, and also the player himself developing as he's got older.
But he's only 20. He's only just 21. If you look at him having signed when he was just 18, or maybe just before he was 18, from Southampton, I don't think anybody would really have expected him to be a first team player for those first couple of years. I think it was all about him developing and then maturing into the kind of player he is. It's probably rare that somebody actually falls into that category and falls into that that time frame of really developing at the age of 21, 22, making that jump and progressing in that way. But if you look at it, it's not... He's just done what probably Damian Comolli would have expected or hoped that he did when he signed him.
When I was 18, if I compared to the type of player I was by the time I made the late 20s, you do some daft things when we're young. And I'm not saying Gareth Bale's done these, but many have. You totally mature. Your highs and lows it is a real roller coaster ride as a younger player. Theo Walcott, I'd argue in a similar way, it's going to be a roller coaster ride for him. But like Ollie said, just 21 coming up. You know, what are we expecting? He'll be a far better player by his mid-20s and late-20s and more consistent than the ups and downs of a young player.
Oh, one other point on Spurs, William Gallus. Thumbs up or thumbs down? Quickly, Cass.
Thumbs down.
Ollie.
If he plays all the time, thumbs up.
Tom.
Thumbs down.
And for me, thumbs up. I love me some William Gallus. Stoke. We talk about bad luck and injuries. I got the sense. They spent a lot of money this summer on Kenwyn Jones. The guy gets hurt. They spent a lot of money on John Walters, which surprised me a little bit. Nearly $3 million for a guy in mid-career from Ipswich. Is this the season that Stoke were supposed to kick on a little bit? Was that the idea? Because they look a lot like last year's team.
I think Tony Pulis is just trying to consolidate and then add to the group and just slightly, nips and tucks here. I think he'd be delighted if he got to mid-table. I think Stoke are a particular side that very few play like in Premiership football. You might argue, Gab, that they're not as direct, but every time I watch them, things are coming in from everywhere at the box. They had a big... Sidibe got injured, didn't he? Which is a bit of a blow. He's out all season. If they lose Kenwyn Jones, then they're running out of numbers. But he always buys big centre-forwards and just launches the thing in. It's a strange one. I'm surprised that them getting beat at Wolves and then getting beaten at home by Tottenham. That's really made me think a little bit differently about Stoke than from last year.
Ollie.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We mentioned Kenwyn Jones there. I mean, he's replaced Beachy with Jones. Apart from the fact that they probably have the same suit size, they're sort of different type of players, and maybe that's what got me thinking. Maybe Pulis is trying to do things slightly differently. Am I wrong?
I think Jones is a bit more mobile, a bit more technical, perhaps. I don't think he's quite got the aggression that you'd expect of somebody his size. But I think you look at the signing of Tunçay a year ago. I mean, Tunçay, Ricardo Fuller, Matthew Etherington, they're not big bruisers or brutes that can't kick a ball. I think gradually as they've become a little bit more at home in the Premier League, I think they have started to try to move in that direction. They're not going to sacrifice what they're good at, but they're going to try to become a little bit more expansive. Yet I think they'll still try to play to their strengths. I think it's the natural thing to do, and I don't really have an issue with it. And I don't think a poor start to the season will really persist.
All right, on to our debate this week. And we're going to talk managers. Now, Aston Villa, of course, looking for a new manager. I was amused by the fact that sort of immediately after Martin O'Neill decided to part ways with the club on August 9th, there was a list out from the bookies with a bunch of names on there, which shocked me because as far as I knew, this was completely unplanned and Randy Lerner and his folks didn't have a plan B. But obviously, they've got a managerial hunt on now. Kevin McDonald's liked by a lot of people, but he's obviously had ups and downs, more downs this weekend. What I'm curious about is these names that are being mentioned. We've had Bob Bradley, who spoke very openly to the media this weekend on 5 Live. Of course, Bob Bradley's contract with the U.S. Soccer Federation is expiring in December, and he's looking for a renewal, which I'm sure might have something to do with it. But what strikes me is all these names are sort of seem to be out of work, big names or people from abroad. And I hearken back to the days when, Ron Atkinson starts out at a small club in the lower division. Sir Alex Ferguson starts out at a small club in the lower division. Graham Taylor, same thing. Are the managers in the championship just a whole bunch of absolute dross, and so it's not worth anybody trying to promote from the championship?
No, they're not. There's some really good managers in the championship that have done amazing jobs. I mean, my old club, Kenny Jackett at Millwall, I think Ian Atkins at Scunthorpe has done brilliant keeping them on that level. I think it's just totally, it's like fashionable where you have to name someone that appease the fans. That's the problem. These managers are not getting a look in the championship level because it's not an exciting transfer. I'm not putting bums on seats. And I think one thing I would say, Gab, I think that Randy Lerner wanted Mark Hughes. And I think the timing of the incoming and outgoings of Martin O'Neill was determined by Hughes taking the Fulham job. I think Martin O'Neill had got a smell that Hughes was going to Villa Park, and I think it all came together. So
that's an interesting,
and that surprised. That's why he's, when you mentioned Randy Lerner, and that looks like they didn't know where they were going. I think they were taken back by O'Neill leaving, like he did.
I mean, that's a spin on things, but it kind of supports the issue here, because Randy Lerner, his first thought is, ooh, O'Neill might leave. Oh, all right, who is the best possible unattached manager who's played for the biggest possible, who's coached the biggest possible club in England that I can get? Ah, it's Mark Hughes. So that's why we get this sort of this churn of the same guys.
Yeah.
Ollie, when I think back, with the exception of Roberto Martinez at Wigan and Paul Ince at Blackburn, the last manager without Premier League experience to be taken out of the Championship and into the Premier League was David Moyes, who I believe is actually the third longest serving manager in the Premier League, so that must be a good 7 or 8 years ago. What's happened?
I think even when at the time when Everton appointed Moyes, who was at Preston at the time, I think that was seen as quite a departure from the way clubs had been doing things at the time. You looked at Chelsea appointing Vialli and then Ranieri, you know, around a similar time, and you know there was very much a trend towards what I think I can't remember who referred to him as designer managers, and I think Moyes went against that. Went against that trend, and you would have to say that he's been one of the greatest managerial appointments of the past 10 years. If you look down into the Championship, you see people like Paul Lambert at Norwich, who's an excellent manager, Sean O'Driscoll, people like that. Someone like Dave Jones at Cardiff, who's an extremely good manager. But I think if we're looking for a club to take a chance on one of these managers, I don't think it's necessarily going to be Aston Villa, who are owned by an American who's fairly hands-on without necessarily having a great grasp on English football, who have got a chief executive, Paul Faulkner, who I'm told is very good, but isn't really an experienced football person. So in some ways, it would be a surprise if they were to go down that route.
Hey, Tom, what gets me, though, is, if we're going to come out and say that guys like Sean O'Driscoll or Simon Grayson, who's also been mentioned by some of us romantics, would be a big gamble, wouldn't a guy like Bob Bradley, who I might add, has never, ever, ever been in a position to buy and sell players and make the kind of decisions a manager is asked to do in this country. He's always had a general manager, director of football above him. Wouldn't he be an even bigger gamble?
For sure. He'd be, exactly as you say, an even bigger gamble. He's not even got the greatest reputations in the United States. A lot of people in the States are perhaps hoping that he doesn't stay on as their manager. And US were okay in the World Cup, but not exceptional. Perhaps a bit disappointing they didn't get further and almost didn't make it beyond the group stages. So I'm not sure that Bob Bradley has done enough as US manager to warrant taking charge of a top six, top eight Premier League club without going to a Championship club first and then proving himself in English club football.
I mean, there's a similar thing really in terms of the foreign managers that we talk about. They're only... they're only really the guys who get interviewed for these jobs. They're only the sort of Ronald Koemans and Didier Deschamps. And Martin Yol seemed a bit of a left field appointment to some extent when he got Spurs initially as a coaching job, not as a manager's job. I think we're a bit narrow-minded generally in this country about the managers that we think about. If you think of the idea of Villa picking from a supposed shortlist of Eriksen, Kerbishley, Bob Bradley—it just seems bizarre. But it wouldn't really surprise me if they ended up picking from that list. It seems almost that the names in the bookmakers are the boards and the media's first port of call in terms of who they take for a job.
What surprises me, Ollie, and Tom Gabb in football, is that take West Ham when Zola went there. Yes, a great name and a great player, but down the road in Dagenham, John Steele had an amazing time with Dagenham and Redbridge, turned them into a club. But that would not go down well with anybody, media, fans, the club. He wouldn't seem to have the character. And yet, that is typical of football all over the country in England. Yes, it might be not a great choice. You might look and think, oh, yeah, Dagenham and West Ham. But why do top players who've got no management experience get given jobs far more than guys who've been on the road and done an amazing job at many, many different clubs, keeping them afloat and keeping them going?
I'll throw it back to you, because an argument that I often hear, and it usually comes from people who were never professional footballers, so it's great to have you here to fill me in, is that, oh, but unless you got a big name, then the players wouldn't respect them. I mean, oh, well, if you brought in, I don't know, like Ian Atkins, then, but Ashley Young and Gabby Bonlahor might not respect them, because they'd be tough. Like, who the hell are you?
Tough.
But does it really work? I mean, you've played for some pretty famous managers, some no-names.
Alex Ferguson have the same player walking into the dressing room at Manchester United?
Well, what gets me here, and this is my appeal to you, Randy Lerner, is Villa are sort of in a unique position now, in the sense that, realistically, it's going to be very difficult for Villa to reach the top four this season. Mm. I think whoever they appoint. By the same token, Villa are going to finish top 10. It's just not going to happen that they won't. You know, regardless of who manages the club. So it seems to me that there's actually, right now, in this moment in time, there's a very limited downside to Villa going out and saying, hey, I will take a punt on a Sean O'Driscoll or a Simon Grayson or Tisdale or whatever that guy is, and come out and say, you know what, you're going to come in, I'm going to give you a two-year deal, it's not going to be for a lot of money, because, you know, you are Simon Grayson or Sean O'Driscoll. So, you know, I don't have a big commitment to you. You show me that you can take all these, you know, good young players that Martin O'Neill has put together, and that you can do a good job with them. If it doesn't work out, I mean, what happened to Blackburn after Paul Ince didn't work out? They got rid of him. They brought in Sam Allardyce, and they stayed up more or less comfortably. So clearly the downside to rolling the dice a little isn't that big. Am I wrong, Tom? Or Ollie?
No, you're right. It'd be a great thing to see, and it'd be brilliant for the reputation of the Football League's managers if that did happen and went well for Villa. I suppose you could say that Lerner is, by the fact that he's thinking about appointing Kevin McDonald, the youth coach, who is in with a good chance of becoming manager, although losing 6-0 to Newcastle was probably not going to do wonders for his chances. I think Lerner is considering appointing a man with no managerial experience, even though that is someone from within the club. So that could be perhaps a middle way between appointing a lower league manager and appointing a celebrity, a big name, to give Kevin McDonald the job and see how he does.
And let's not forget that, you know, we're talking about a replacement for the supposedly irreplaceable Martin O'Neill, who, when Leicester City took a punt on him in 1995, was sort of struggling to some extent at Norwich City, having just been sent, you know, plucked from Wycombe Wanderers. So it's, teams have taken chances on managers down the years, and it has worked. And I think, I would love to see Villa and Randy Lerner take that approach that you talk of, and gamble to some extent on the best manager around, but ideally not one who is famous chiefly because they had a good playing reputation.
Well, and that's what gets me ultimately to wrap this up, is the fact that people say the stakes are too high. You can't gamble on it. But what stakes? You're Aston Villa. You will finish in the top 10 no matter what happens. And, you know, there's just so many terrible teams in the Premier League that you can afford to roll the dice a little bit for something that can make you a lot better. All right, now time for what I like to call quick hits, and my producer Skinner likes to call off the fence. We've changed things around this week, and because I'm in control, I shall be asking every single question. Kenny Wang, that's funny, has blamed Martin Broughton, the Liverpool chairman, for the fact that he pulled out of his bid to buy the club. Ollie, does he have a point? And given that if a buyer isn't found in the next 8 days, another £20 million will be piled onto the club's debt, which already stands at £237 million. How worrisome a time is this for Liverpool supporters?
I think it's extremely worrying for fans of Liverpool supporters. I think there would have been worries even had Huang bought the club, and I think there were a lot of unanswered questions about that bid, which may or may not yet return to the table. But to me, you know, it seemed increasingly like there might not be light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, there are suggestions that there are still buyers out there, credible buyers, but they'd better hurry up and make an offer because it seems like they're not there at the moment.
Maybe David Morris can buy the club back. Andy Carroll scores a hat-trick as Newcastle demolished Villa 6-0. Franco Baldini, Fabio Capello's assistant, was in the stands. Cass, you know a thing or two about big target men. Is he ready now for an England call-up? And if not, what more does he need to do?
Well, because of Crouch certainly out of the frame now, and then the retirement of Emil Heskey, I think he's got every chance of being in the next England squad. I thought he played well at Man United on Monday night. I thought he gave Man United a few problems, could have got a goal. He's got a hat-trick. He showed all the traits of, you know, big centre-forward play. I don't believe he's as slow as some people say he is. I think he's got a lot to offer and he has to improve. The biggest problem is going to be Andy Carroll himself because I do believe he's a wild card.
Chelsea had their own 6-0 victory, pounding Wigan at the stadium formerly known as the JJB. Tom, can you please tell us just why Chelsea have got out of the gate so quickly this season?
Because they've played two terrible teams in the first two games. So pretty much as simple as that. I actually think beating Wigan 6-0 was a pretty poor result for Chelsea. Beat them 8-0 on the last game of last season. So where's the improvement? They've actually gone backwards by two goals. It took them 34 minutes to get a shot on target when Malouda scored. And this is a team, a Wigan team, that just lost 4-0 at home to Blackpool the week before. I think if I was Chelsea, I'd be a bit worried that it wasn't more like 10-0.
Carlo Ancelotti, if you're listening to this, your team's regressing. Please fix it. And Tom Dart, you got the bell treatment. Wouldn't be complete without mentioning the other 6-0 as Arsenal trounced Blackpool. Ollie, the boy Walcott, scored a hat-trick. Has he turned the corner? Or is he still one of those guys who can only perform when he doesn't have to think about what he's doing on the pitch, as certain pundits intimate?
Was that a 25-second question?
You're eating into your own time, boy.
Okay. I think the danger really is saying that everything's fantastic, the pennies drop, Walcott is now world-class, he's learnt from being left out of the World Cup squad, etc. I thought his hat-trick on Saturday was excellent, but it was all... I'll be happier about Walcott and his long-term development when he's showing more sort of incisive, intelligent, insightful wing play. That's what he's still got to develop, and that's what everybody will be looking for between now and the end of the season.
Mikel Arteta is now eligible to play for England based on residency. Some Preston-born Irishman-turned-pundits say it wouldn't be right. Cass, what does a Kent-born Irishman like yourself have to say about it?
I think this is pushing the boat way too far, Gab. Look, he obviously has no ancestry of being English. I don't like the rule of playing in a country for a certain amount of time. It makes you eligible. So, no, I'm completely thumbs down.
Only 2 weeks in, but more than 20% of Premier League matches have finished with 6-0 scorelines. Tom, is this just a statistical quirk, or is there more than meets the eye?
I think you have to say that Newcastle beating Villa 6-0 was distinctly quirky. Otherwise, I think it's just a case of very, very good established Premier League teams meeting poor new boys and just demolishing them. I think generally, though, you could argue whether in the past couple of years in the Premier League and in football generally, we've seen attackers and forwards getting more skillful, quicker, more dangerous, but have defensive qualities improved as much. We get a lot of focus on defensive midfielders, but what about centre-backs? Are they really improving at the same level?
My personal view is no. We got a lot of pretty awful defenders in this league.
Gab, one for you. Tell us about Arsenal's new defender, Sebastian Scolacci, who's undergoing a medical today.
Well, Cass, why don't you tell me about him since you actually played in France?
Will I get the bell treatment?
No, well, Sebastian Scolacci got a lot of hype earlier in his career, was very promising. Monaco helped Monaco reach a Champions League final against the special one, Jose Mourinho, then moved to Lyon, won a couple of titles, then went to Seville. Had a bit of an up and down time at Seville, but look, the guy's got 21 caps for France. He's athletic, and I think he adds much needed depth to the Arsenal defense. Cass, good job there ringing the bell. That's all we've got time for today, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all the latest news, some gossip, some columns, some opinions, some blogs, all the transfer latest, and of course, transfer window about to wind down. And also, you can join us for our web chats. Ollie K does one, Gary Jacob does one, I do one every Monday. So thanks for listening this week, and we'll catch you all next Monday. Take care.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.